KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. One estimate says President Trump's tariffs bring in money to cover a lot of federal spending, but who would pay? We'll hear from Democratic Senator Tim Kaine in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump broke with Elon Musk yesterday on television and on social media. Another member of Trump's coalition had been pulling for this, and in this hour, how the fight looks to Trump's sometime advisor, Steve Bannon. Also, are President Trump's deals with law firms legal? And Family Guy's Seth MacFarlane takes on song arrangements made for Frank Sinatra. It's Friday, June 6th. This day in 1933, a drive-in movie theater opened, run by a man who had patented the idea. He said the whole family was welcome, even if the kids were noisy. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A group of Democratic attorneys general is in federal court in Boston this morning. They're challenging President Trump's executive order on voting. He's seeking changes, including proof of citizenship to vote in federal elections. And Trump wants to force states to stop counting mailed ballots that are postmarked by the election but arrive after Election Day is over. The attorneys general say that Trump's order violates federal law. They also allege voting matters are decided by states and by Congress, not by a president. There is little indication of any reconciliation between President Trump and his former ally, billionaire Elon Musk, this morning. Musk has been extremely critical of the multi-trillion-dollar tax cut and spending bill pending in Congress. It features President Trump's priorities. Musk says the bill would supersize the deficit. He and Trump traded increasingly personal attacks on each other yesterday. Now, another of Trump's allies, right-wing activist and former White House advisor Steve Bannon, is weighing in. Bannon believes that Musk has gone too far.
He crossed the Rubicon. You can't listen. It's one thing to make comments about the spending on the bill. There's another thing about what he did. Okay, you can't sit there and first off try to destroy the bill. You can't come out and say kill the president's most important legislative occurrence of this first term.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The Labor Department says that U.S. employers created 139,000 jobs last month. That's a little more than analysts were forecasting. The May report suggests that there has not been significant harm to the labor market from federal government layoffs and President Trump's tariffs. For the second year, Muslims in Gaza will not be able to celebrate one of Islam's most important holidays, Eid al-Adha. Devastated by Israeli bombardments and with only a trickle of aid allowed into the enclave, Palestinians have no access to fresh food and meat, a mainstay of Eid celebrations. NPR's Carrie Khan has more.
If Palestinians are able to find meat or livestock to slaughter for the festival of sacrifice, the prices are astronomical. Israel's nearly three-month-long blockade of all goods into Gaza depleted food stocks. There's been a limited lifting of the ban, but only a trickle of trucks have been allowed into Gaza since, bringing in mainly flour. The UN, which is warning of widespread famine in Gaza, says it struggles to deliver aid due to looting and shifting Israeli military restrictions. Israel says it must impose strict controls to make sure Hamas doesn't steal aid. A U.S. private group backed by Israel to bring in dry food goods posted on its Facebook page that its sites were closed and urged people to stay away for their safety. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 450 points. This is NPR. The city of Portland, Oregon, will pay $8.5 million in a legal settlement to 26 descendants of black city residents. The residents were driven out of their Portland homes and businesses to make way for development projects between the late 1950s through the 1970s. The descendants had sued the city, arguing Portland had conspired to destroy a thriving black neighborhood. Human rights groups are among those criticizing a new security law passed by lawmakers in Italy. As NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from Rome, the law gives police more authority to crack down on protesters.
During the vote in Italy's Senate, the session was temporarily suspended as opposition lawmakers staged a protest on the chamber floor, shouting the word shame repeatedly. The decree proposed by Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni brings harsher punishments for acts like passive resistance in prisons and migrant detention centres. It criminalises public protest actions like the blocking of roads and allows for the imprisonment of convicted pregnant women or those with babies. Amnesty International has called it draconian, and protests across Italy have taken place against the decree in recent months. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Today is the 81st anniversary of D-Day. This was the start of the Allied operation in 1944 to land Allied troops on the French shore of Normandy. It began the last Allied assault on Nazi Germany. The operation had been kept secret until hundreds of thousands of Allied troops stormed the French shore. There are commemorations today in Normandy. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. The president has been promising his tariffs will help make America more prosperous, and there is evidence that tariffs are at least helping the government's bottom line. Reports from the Treasury Department show that Trump's tariffs have raised nearly $70 billion so far this year, and a new forecast out this week says if that keeps up, it could shave trillions of dollars off the federal debt over the next decade. NPR's Scott Horsley is following all this. Hi there, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so this forecast comes from an organization the White House doesn't like when they say things like lots of deficit spending coming, but they do like it in this case. So what is it?
Yeah, it's the Congressional Budget Office, which says if all the tariffs in place at the beginning of the week stayed in effect for a full decade, it could cut the federal debt by $2.8 trillion, which is in the ballpark of that big tax cut and spending bill passed by the House, what it's expected to add to the debt over the next 10 years. In other words, the tariffs could help to fill the hole that congressional Republicans have been digging with that tax and spending bill. But keep in mind, the tariff revenue isn't just coming out of thin air and is not being paid by foreign countries. It's mostly being paid by Americans, like Patrick Allen. He's a wine importer in Columbus, Ohio.
That revenue comes from somewhere. It's a tax on the backs of the people that are importing either raw materials or, in my case, wine. We're the people that are paying this tax, and eventually it gets built into the price everybody's paying for goods.
And congressional forecasters acknowledge as much. They say while the tariffs will bring in a lot of money for the government, they will also likely lead to higher inflation and slower economic growth.
How much of a drag on the overall economy are these tariffs then?
Yeah, the CBO projects a fairly small drag, but it's really just a guess because we don't have any recent experience with tariffs of this size. You'd have to go all the way back to the Great Depression to find import taxes this high in the United States. So Shia Kabas, who's been keeping tabs on the tariffs at the Bipartisan Policy Center, says a lot of economists are worried the tariffs will actually do more damage than the CBO is predicting.
Some are forecasting larger impacts and potentially pushing us into a recession. We won't know if that actually materializes until we see the fallout.
And the tariffs themselves have been really unpredictable as the president tries to negotiate with U.S. trading partners. So that presents another challenge, not only for forecasters, but more importantly, for the businesses and families who are trying to make decisions in this environment.
How do businesses handle that unpredictability, changing tariffs day by day?
It's really challenging. Patrick Allen's wine business, for example, typically works with three-month lead times.
We're a small company, so we drive the back roads of France and find these small wineries. We buy the wine from the winery, import it into the U.S.
And right now, Allen should be ordering wine to sell during the fall and the Christmas holidays, but a lot of his customers are sitting on their hands because they have no idea what the tariff is going to be.
Say if I order $100,000 of wine from France, if there's a 20% tariff, I'll have to pay $20,000 to get the wine out of customs before I sell a bottle.
I talked to a customs broker last week who used to advance her clients money to pay the tariffs. And, you know, she could do that when the import tax was 2 or 2.5%. But with today's much higher rates, she's not doing that anymore. Clients have to pay the tariffs up front on their own. So while these import taxes are raising money for the government, they're also gumming up the gears of commerce. Alan told me at least he's got some nice French wine to soothe himself with.
Hope you're able to pour yourself a glass, Scott. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, joins us next. He's on the Senate Budget Committee. Senator, welcome back.
Steve, good to be with you.
Okay, so I want to note, for people who don't know, you have been concerned about the budget deficit, the amount that we borrow every year, the federal debt, the amount of borrowing or debt that accumulates over time. According to the CBO, the tariffs would reduce the deficit. Is that useful even if you dislike tariffs?
Steve, you've described one piece of the puzzle. The CBO said this Trump tariff regime, which is essentially a sales tax, as the previous guest described, is going to raise a lot of revenue. And that raising of revenue will do three things. It will reduce the deficit. It will raise costs on everyday Americans for groceries and building supplies, home supplies, clothes, and it will also shrink the economy. So if that was the only piece of the puzzle, of course, we'd be talking about, should we be shrinking the economy to reduce the deficit? Should we be reducing the deficit off the backs of everyday people rather than, you know, the wealthy? But it's not the only piece of the puzzle, because basically what the tariff revenue is doing, it's being used to finance a huge tax cut for the wealthiest, together with cuts in everyday programs that people rely on, like Medicaid and nutrition assistance.
So it would pay down federal debt, but it would cause someone making $70,000 or $50,000 a year to pay it rather than somebody making $70 million or $50 million. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. The distributional effect of tariffs, because it's a sales tax, and economists have long said sales taxes are regressive. They hit low and middle income people much harder than upper income people, because lower and middle income people spend more of their income on purchasing things rather than, you know, socking it away in savings or the stock market. So yeah, is it fair to reduce the deficit off the backs of everyday folks rather than make, you know, the wealthiest carry a fair share? So again, the piece of the puzzle, reduce deficit, sure, but raise costs on everyday people and shrink the economy, is it worth it? You add to it this reduction of all the key programs people rely on, this mm-hmm. reconciliation bill. And now you see Donald Trump's trying to do in term two what he did in term one, a tax break that benefits the wealthiest at the expense of everybody else.
Understood. I have to ask you about this other news, the breakup at the White House. President Trump and Elon Musk very publicly breaking up just after Elon Musk left government service. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, surprise. So I think anybody who kind of is aware of the personalities of these two individuals would have predicted the breakup. But some of the way it's breaking up, some of the ferocity of Musk's comments. I mean, he was just, you know, given a golden key to the White House, I think it was last week. And then all of a sudden, it's all turned bad. You know, Musk is concerned about some features of this bill, the deficit effect of the reconciliation. You've had my Senate colleague Ron Johnson on talking about the same thing.
Sure.
And so there are many things about this bill that cause grave concern, and that's why the House product is taken on an awful lot of water in the Senate. And if the Senate does pass this back to the House, I think it's going to be in dramatically different form.
Dramatically different form, meaning lower deficits, among other things?
Well, I tell you, for my sake, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to offer amendments and say, here would be an example. Hey, if you don't extend deep estate tax cuts for the wealthiest, you don't have to cut food assistance to poor families. Now, so everybody in the chamber, let's vote on that. Why give estate tax relief to the wealthiest to take food away from families, poor families and kids? Mm-hmm. We're going to put up amendments like that. And I think some of these amendments will be pretty darn salient. And then you'll see Ron Johnson putting up amendment to reduce the deficit. I mean, there's going to be all kinds of proposals to change this bill.
One other thing, very briefly, the president yesterday threatened to take away Elon Musk's contracts. We don't know if that's going to happen. Maybe they'll make up. Who knows? But he made the threat. Is that an appropriate use of presidential power?
Well, I think most of what President Trump is doing, unilateral threats, not a good use of presidential power. And just back to tariffs. I'm starting tariffs. I'm delaying them. I may give you a waiver. I may give you an exception. The point you made about unpredictability is keeping a lot of Virginia companies on the sidelines who want to make investments, but they're not going to make investments till things settle down. Will they settle down under a President Trump? I think you got to really wonder about that.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, it's a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
Take care. We have an update now on a story we reported the other day. We told you about a study that confirmed that singing to babies can boost their health and happiness. We asked you, what do you croon to your little ones? And more than 1,000 people responded. Thank you. Here are some of our favorites.
I'm Kelsey Webb.
And I'm Derek Webb.
And our baby's name is Phoebe. And we're from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
W-X-N-Y and Phoebe.
Oh, perfect harmony. Their one-year-old loves hearing the entire book of Dr. Seuss's ABC.
The rhymes in that book just flow so well that it was easy to just make up a tune and sing that with her.
Mm-hmm. And it just made it more fun to sing and more fun to read to her, and she loves it.
She loves it, loves it, loves it.
Oh. Dr. Seuss's ABC.
In Pinckney, Michigan, Tim Claremont loves coming home to have a full-on jam session with his kids.
Music is a huge part of our lives, and every day I sing and play guitar and we have sing-alongs.
Okay, Tim and his wife Mary have two kids, Dottie, who is 4, and Stu, who is 2.
When I get home from work, Stu comes running up to the door holding his little guitar, and he keeps saying, yeah, 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 which means that he wants to hear the Beatles' She Loves You. So I run and get my guitar, and we have a sing-along.
Glad. Other parents sing the songs their parents sang to them, like Yuki Takabatake in Brooklyn, who was raised in the United States, far from where her family is now, in Japan.
This song is called Amefuri. Ame, ame, fure, fure, kaasan ga, jan no me de omukae ureshii na. And Amefuri is a traditional Japanese folk song. And it's about a child that is caught in the rain and is joyfully met by their mom, who brings an umbrella.
Mm. The songs she heard as a child keep traditions alive for her almost 2-year-old.
Now, I'm not in any way a great singer, but singing these songs is a way for us to stay connected across all these different generations and across the ocean.
Oh, gosh, and I feel connected to you guys. Thank you for sharing these bundles of joy. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Alf Clausen, who composed, arranged, and orchestrated the music on The Simpsons in its early days, including Emmy-winning song parodies. Also, how the brain forgets and remembers. We talk with neuroscientist Charan Raghunath, author of Why We Remember. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And Amy Martinez. Seth MacFarlane is best known for shows such as Family Guy and the Ted franchise, which he created and starred in. He also co-created American Dad. But did you know MacFarlane is also a Grammy-nominated singer five times over? And now he's recorded for the first time arrangements written originally for the late Frank Sinatra.
On a wonderful day like today, I defy any cloud to appear in the sky.
The album is called Lush Life, the Lost Sinatra Arrangements. On a recent stop at our studios in Culver City, California, MacFarlane told me how he got a fateful call from Sinatra's daughter, Tina, asking him if he'd like to purchase the arrangements.
And I said, hell yeah. And what we found was about 1,200 songs that he had never recorded. And we found, you know, an arrangement of Shadow of Your Smile that was arranged by Nelson Riddle, who was the quintessential Sinatra orchestrator, that he had never recorded from the early 1960s.
Wow, why wouldn't someone take credit for it?
You know, right? it's at the time, great songwriting in the purest sense was so ubiquitous. And nowadays, like, find somebody who can write Singin' in the Rain. It doesn't exist.
Moonlight there in the sky, a sight no one in love forgets.
We found a song from the Come Fly With Me album that had been cut from that album that was mid-50s and arranged by Billy Mitchell.
I, Rio, Rio by the sea, oh, flying down to Rio where there's rhythm and rhyme.
So we hired an orchestra over on the Fox lot, and we just went through these boxes and we played as many as we could.
Whenever I hear someone try Frank Sinatra songs in karaoke, it's like they try their vocal mannerisms of Frank.
Yep.
How do you try and be you, but also give the essence and sense of Frank?
I had the luxury of, before they passed away, of training with Lee and Sally Sweetland, who were two contemporaries of Sinatra, and, you know, worked with him, worked with Dean Martin, worked with Streisand. Like, you know, they just taught you how to sing the way these songs are supposed to be sung. The best of Sinatra to me are his ballad albums. And he's singing like he's at a concert hall. He's singing like he's singing an opera. And there's nothing about it that evokes any of those kind of gimmicky mannerisms that people sometimes do.
Yeah, his association with Las Vegas and the casinos. I think that,
yeah,
for people that don't listen to his music, think, well, that makes, yeah, him a lounge act. Much like, say, an Elvis song would be a tiki bar kind of,
right,
kind of song.
If you listen to a Sinatra album like Only the Lonely, like, that's an album that you hear and you go, oh, I have been thinking about this guy all wrong.
Each place I go, only
that's him doing what he does best, and there's not a swing tune anywhere to be found.
So let's hear Give Me the Simple Life.
I never was cut out to step and strut out. Give me the simple life.
I'm trying hard, Seth, not to like snap my fingers and move along.
Just realize this is just like two guys sitting in a record booth trying not to make eye contact with each other.
Yeah, so I did try not to make eye contact with you. I don't know why.
Give me the simple life.
When I hear the opening of that song, is it's those flutes that are, you know, it's those trombones that are just unmistakably Nelson Riddle. It's like, oh yeah, this is a Sinatra tune, but we'd never heard it before.
Do you ever remember the first time you heard Frank sing?
I didn't really listen to Sinatra until I was in college. I remember thinking, my God, it's not just that he's singing great, his backing arrangements are fantastic. It's like nothing I've ever heard. Like, it just blows everything out of the water. When you listen to his recording of Laura, there's like a minute-long intro where it's just the orchestra.
Laura is the face in the misty light.
What song out of this album did you like the best?
I mean, Lush Life is an interesting one because it's the only song in the record where there's any kind of a blueprint.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come-what-may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life.
Sinatra got into the studio and did half of Lush Life. It's a beautiful, almost classical arrangement. Everything else is We're Flying Blind.
I mean, for a lot of people that maybe don't know that you've actually been nominated for a Grammy 5 times.
Yeah.
They're going to see this and say, what?
Yeah, it's funny. No matter how many records we put out, there's always the people who are kind of just figuring out that we do this on the side. The first record was like 2010 or something like that. So only now do I feel like I'm equipped to pull something like this off.
Now, what would you try to pull off next?
There are more. Like, there are probably enough unused charts in those boxes for at least 2 more albums.
You push boundaries all the time. I'm wondering, you know, I have discussions with my uncle all the time. He's a big supporter of President Trump, big supporter of the Republican Party. And one of the things he tells me about Democrats that he thinks they need is showmanship, in that President Trump is a showman.
Yep.
He knows how to work a crowd, knows how to work a screen.
Yep.
You're a big supporter of the Democratic Party. I mean, do you think the Democratic Party needs a showman or showwoman?
I think that's very, very true. It, you know, it's so cliche to say it, but it, you know, each medium that comes along, you have to be in step with it. And so, yeah, I think we are living in a time when, like, showmanship is, and a specific type of showmanship. You got to be loud. You have to make noise. You have to surprise people. And is that my cup of tea? Not necessarily, but it is the reality, I think.
That is Seth MacFarlane. His new album is called Lush Life, the Lost Sinatra Arrangement. Seth, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Ain't you ever coming back, ain't you? Can't you see the difference it makes? I'm half myself without your kisses. One more night of doing without them will drive me crazy. Won't you make me smile?
This is NPR News.
Mary Ann Faithful was an icon of the British invasion in the 1960s.
She was the queen of doom and gloom. But, you know, she wasn't really like that in the flesh, you know. She was very funny and upbeat and charming.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We speak with the executive producer of her posthumous EP, Burning Moonlight, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News. I sit and watch as tears go by.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. House Speaker Mike Johnson is weighing in on the ongoing feud between President Trump and tech billionaire Elon Musk. Speaking on CNN, Johnson urged the two sides to put aside their differences.
I could just say he was disappointed. I mean, he said that himself, and I was as well. But I believe in redemption. I hope we can resolve it and get everybody together again. That's really important for all of us.
Musk blasted the Republican-backed tax cut and spending package this week, calling it a, quote, disgusting abomination. The bill is projected to add an estimated $2.4 trillion to the national deficit. The man accused of using a makeshift flamethrower and Molotov cocktails to attack demonstrators in Boulder, Colorado, is appearing in federal court today. He made his second court appearance on Thursday on state charges. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Doherty says Mohammed Soleiman is facing 118 counts.
The charges reflect the evidence that we have regarding this horrific attack that took place and the seriousness of it. So the defendant's charged with attempted murder in the first degree as to 14 different victims. Each one of those counts carries a sentence of 16 to 48 years.
More than a dozen people were injured in last Sunday's attack, including an 88-year-old Holocaust survivor. This is NPR News in Washington. Air quality and dense fog alerts are in effect today in at least six states. Smoke from a series of wildfires burning across central Canada continues to drift southward into the United States. The National Weather Service says they include areas of Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. American tennis star Coco Gauff has advanced to the final of the French Open. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports she'll take on the top-ranked player from Belarus for the chance to win her second Grand Slam title.
In the semifinal, Coco Gauff faced a crowd favorite in the French player Loïs Boisson, who is making a Cinderella run through the Open despite being ranked just 361st in the world. Gauff shut the door on Boisson's fairy tale ending by beating her in straight sets 6-1, 6-2. Her victory sets up a final between the top two players in the world, a first for the French Open in the past three decades. Aryna Sabalenka is number one after a stellar 2024 in which she won both the Australian Open and the U.S. Open. And Gauff is number two. Gauff hasn't won a Grand Slam since her thrilling U.S. Open victory 2 years ago, but the person she beat there was Sabalenka. The final will take place Saturday. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The Indiana Pacers came from behind last night to beat the Oklahoma City Thunder in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. The final score was 111 to 110. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Migrant detainees staged a protest at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement-run facility in Miami on Thursday. For this protest, they lined up in the courtyard of the Chrome Detention Center and spelled out the letters SOS with their own bodies. The protest was captured by local news helicopters. NPR immigration correspondent Jasmine Garst has been following the conditions at this particular facility for months and is on the line. Jasmine, good morning.
Good morning.
I want people to know that you've had dozens of recorded conversations over time with detainees in Chrome and also with their families. So what are you hearing?
This facility has had problems for years, and right now we're seeing severe overcrowding. Detainees have reported illnesses, limited access to medication. One of the first tips we received about Chrome was from a woman named Maria. She asked that her last name be withheld to protect her brother, who she says has had a serious eye infection with a fever for 2 weeks and hasn't gotten medication.
Estaba durmiendo en el piso, no les daban comida.
They've been sleeping on the floor, she said. They aren't always being fed. The food is sometimes spoiled. And I heard this consistently, people going hungry. There's evidence this is a national problem. ICE detention centers are at about 125% capacity. I spoke to Setare Gandahari from the advocacy group Detention Watch Network.
You know, people are really just languishing without access to necessities. I've heard people use the word starving.
Well, when people use words like starving about a U.S. government facility where people are being detained, how does ICE respond?
ICE acknowledged that there is overcrowding right now. They told NPR in an email, quote, "We are actively implementing measures to manage capacity while maintaining compliance with federal standards and our commitment to humane treatment." These accusations do not reflect ICE's policies or practices, end quote. Now, ICE says the overcrowding is temporary, but the Trump administration is promising even more arrests.
Useful that they at least acknowledge the overcrowding. No one is denying a problem here. But isn't there a larger problem coming as the administration tries to arrest more and more people to remove them from the country?
Yes, and that's why a major goal for the administration is self-deportation. And some detainees I spoke to are asking to be deported. I recorded this conversation between 28-year-old Venezuelan detainee John Kleiber Ortega. He's been in detention in Florida for around 6 months. He did some time at the Chrome facility.
Hello. Dios te bendiga, mi niño hermoso.
And he says, Mom, they told me in 4 months they'll review my asylum case and I have to present proof I was tortured in Venezuela. That's almost a year in detention and they are barely feeding us in here. So I've asked to be deported back. And then he says to her that he asked the judge, what if my flight accidentally ends up in a third country, like El Salvador? And he says the judge told him, if that happens, you can email me.
Oh. NPR's Jasmine Garst, thanks very much for your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're hearing many voices on the public breakup of President Trump and Elon Musk. One of those voices is Steve Bannon. He's an early Trump backer, a wealthy media figure who went into the first Trump administration, a little like Musk did. Last year, Bannon went to prison for refusing to testify in a congressional investigation of Trump. He also has pleaded guilty to crimes in New York State. He is still seen as an indicator of where parts of Trump's coalition may stand. On this program in January, Bannon criticized Elon Musk and other men around Trump he labeled oligarchs. So we got Bannon on the line this morning. Do you believe it is good for Trump to have this very public breakup?
Whether it's good or not, it's a reality. You know, the president's gone out of his way to make sure that Elon had every opportunity, all the support, admiration, resources. He took him into, actually, you know, he and his son and some of his children into his family, Christmas, all that. You know, Elon asked for an extension to stay, and the president denied it. And I think that was the beginning of this friction. And as I've said before, since December, this was inevitable. And so I just think the president needs to deal with it as a national security issue now.
I think that one thing you said there, I had not specifically heard before. You believe that Elon Musk had asked for an extension of his time as a special government employee?
Yeah, I think Mark Caputo at Axios, I think, said that Elon had asked for an extension or some sort of workaround to the limitation of his time, okay. And it was denied. And the president said it was time to kind of move on. And then also, remember, the president is sitting there saying, like, where's the $1 trillion? You said you're going to get $1 trillion of cut and waste, fraud, and abuse. And quite frankly, there's been no, he hasn't turned up any fraud. So there's been a lot of tension. And Elon Musk, like the 11-year-old child he is, didn't take that very well.
Is Trump really going to follow your advice to cancel his government contracts, his company's government contracts?
Steve, look, I think this is not personal now. I think we have, as a country, a national security issue here. We have an individual that the New York Times has said has a massive drug problem, and that has not been refuted, has not been pushed back on at all. We have an individual that has a deep financial and business relationship with the Chinese Communist Party, and we know he's asked for private briefings of top secret information. He's also somehow involved in this invitation to President Xi or Premier Xi to come to the inauguration. You have someone whose legal status is in question. You can't deport people from all over the world, particularly third world countries that came here at the invitation of the Biden regime, and leave a white South African who may be here illegally here. It's just not right.
We'll just be clear. I mean, Elon Musk is an immigrant, also is a citizen, so we don't know that there's evidence of illegality
Hang on. There's always been a question about overstaying his visa, just like the Egyptian that threw the Molotov cocktails. And all I'm saying should be an investigation.
As dramatic as all of this seems right now, Bill Ackman, another billionaire in the Trump coalition, said publicly they should make up. Elon seemed to agree with that. Politico is now reporting that there's a call of some kind scheduled with the president. Is it possible this whole thing was all just a social media tempest and it's going to blow over?
He crossed the Rubicon. You can't listen. It's one thing to make comments about the spending on the bill. There's another thing about what he did. Okay, you can't sit there and first of all try to destroy the bill. You can't come out and say kill the president's most important legislative occurrence of this first term, number one. Number two, he crossed the Rubicon by this outrageous comparison to the Epstein files about saying President Trump should be impeached and replaced by J.D. Vance. This is so outrageous, and it's crossed the line. He's crossed the Rubicon, and there's no going back.
Steve Bannon, it's a pleasure talking with you again. Thank you so much.
Steve, thank you, and thank you, NPR.
Now, we called Elon Musk for comment, and we have invited him on the program a number of times. Elon, you're welcome. Come on over. We'll let you know if we hear back. This is NPR News.
President Trump's new 50% steel and aluminum tariffs could increase the cost of canned goods. We'll get tips on how to eat healthy on a budget next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. The original Birkin bag is going up for auction. It was designed for the cinema star Jane Birkin in the 80s. The designer of the luxury brand Hermes saw the actress spill the contents of her purse on a flight and said he could do better. And now Birkin sell for tens of thousands. In Sex and the City, a character said it's not a bag, it's a Birkin. And nobody can guess how much this one will sell for. Just reach into the Birkin for your wallet. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Hard to get your brain around this next number. Over the next few decades, around $124 trillion will change hands in the United States through inheritance. Many of those transfers run into problems. Our colleagues from NPR's The Indicator, Sally Herships and Waylon Wong, navigate some thorny questions in estate planning.
Amy Castoro knows how hard talking estate planning can be. It's her job to make those conversations easier. She is CEO and president of the Williams Group.
We make sure the families are all still speaking to each other after the wealth transfers.
There's this one thing that seems to keep tripping families up, a focus on assets, not relationships.
Everybody focuses on estate planning. They focus on preservation of the wealth. They focus on tax strategies. They focus on growing the wealth. Yet the biggest risk is often the family itself.
And by the way, if you're thinking, oh, estate planning, that's a topic just for rich people. No, more than half of the $124 trillion that's expected to be passed down does come from high net worth individuals. But the other half, that is coming from the rest of us.
I've heard it all. It could be a vase. But you know, if you walk the dog back, you find out that it's not really about the vase. It's, did they feel loved?
Think about it. Amy says a will is a legal document. It's designed to take care of assets, i.e. who gets what and when.
You know, moms and dads all have an idea of what they'd like to have happen with that money. But unfortunately, more often than not, roughly 70% of the time, the transition doesn't go as planned.
The guy who founded Amy's company did a 20-year field study looking at where things break down and how to make things right. And he's got a formula for the money to go where it's supposed to and to keep everyone happy.
You should spend 60% of your time on building family trust and communication, 25% preparing your heirs, you know, teaching them to be kind, to care for others, and 10% of your time getting on the same page about the values and mission of your family.
Only 5% of your time should be spent on the mechanical side of estate planning, like figuring out those interest rates, mortgages, investment accounts, that kind of thing.
And yet 95% of people's time is spent on that 5%.
Louis Osterman has seen this firsthand. He's a lawyer in Denver who specializes in estate planning. Like a couple of years ago, he had some clients, a brother and sister.
The biggest issue that we had to iron out was who was going to get dad's vacuum. And
wait a minute. A vacuum cleaner, like a Hoover, like the kind you clean your house with.
Yeah, not even like a Dyson. I don't think it was a nice one.
It's like, no, it's precious. Not the kind of problem, Lewis says, you want to bring in front of a judge.
So we went into the conference room. Sister had a lawyer, and at my hourly rate, she brought the vacuum. We put it on the table. We transferred it over to brother.
So what was the bill for the vacuum transfer?
I think it was about $3,000 to $4,000 in attorney time. I'm still kind of beside myself about it.
Wow. That is nuts.
And here is where we get into our old friend, behavioral economics, and, you know, the concept of rational actors. You know, people don't always make decisions you might call rational, especially if they're feeling stressed or emotional.
Lewis says a question a family shouldn't have to ask is, how much fighting can they afford?
Waylon Wong,
Sally Herships, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. 53 years ago, an image from the Vietnam War shocked the world. A Vietnamese girl who was naked and other children ran down the road after a napalm attack. They were photographed, and this became known as the Napalm Girl photo. It led to a Pulitzer Prize for Associated Press staffer Nick Ut. Now that photo credit is being challenged. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco has our report, and we'll let you know so you're not surprised that you will hear the explosive sounds of war.
The photo, officially titled The Terror of War, captures 9-year-old Kim Phuc fleeing naked, her arms outstretched, after South Vietnamese bomber planes mistakenly targeted her village, Trang Bang.
I saw exactly 4 bombs. Boop, 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 boop. And then that is the moment exploded. And then the fire burned off all my clothes.
Kim Phuc has recounted her story many times, like she did in From Hell to Hollywood, a 2021 documentary about the man she calls Uncle Nick. Nick Ut was then a 21-year-old photojournalist working for the AP Saigon Bureau.
I saw the girl with her arm running, screaming.
Since that day on June 8, 1972, Ut has repeated his recollection as he did for this AP video and in the film.
When she passed to me, I saw her skin come off, the body burned so badly.
Ut remembers rushing Kim Phuc and other children to a nearby hospital, and the photo he says he shot ended up on the front pages of American newspapers, galvanizing the anti-war movement. Ut won the Pulitzer, the World Press Photo of the Year, and other awards. He continued working for the AP in Southern California until his retirement in 2017. Until now, his legacy was unchallenged.
The photograph of Kim Phuc is perhaps the most iconic, famous photograph of a war ever made. And the idea that it might have been made by somebody else other than Nick Ut was devastating, actually.
In his documentary, The Stringer, photojournalist Gary Knight investigates an allegation made by Carl Robinson, who worked at the AP's Saigon Bureau. Robinson claims the late photo editor Horst Foss ordered him to write the photo credit.
And Horst Foss, who had been standing right next to me, said, Nick Ut, make it Nick Ut, make it staff.
Hearing Carl's story that he had deliberately miscredited this photograph, I very quickly started thinking about the person that Carl said had taken the photograph.
Knight runs the Seven Foundation, an organization based in France that trains photojournalists. He and his team hired a French forensics firm to analyze photos, videos, and satellite images. They also tracked down a Vietnamese man named Nguyen Thanh Nay, who was also there that day with a camera. At the premiere of The Stringer at this year's Sundance Film Festival, Nguyen stood up from the audience.
He said, I took the photo, and he got a standing ovation. No matter which perspective you have on that story, him being able to say that after 53 years is important.
The film's director, Bao Nguyen, who's not related to The Stringer, says he grew up revering Nick Ut's work. He says challenging the photo's credit does not take away from the impact of that image.
My parents are refugees from Vietnam. My dad was a soldier in the Southern Vietnamese Army as well. And I often think about my mother and her being around that same age. And so that photograph is deeply personal to me.
Last month, in response to the film, World Press Photo suspended its authorship attribution of the photo. The Associated Press had its own investigation. They concluded they still have questions about who shot the photo, but they kept Nick Ut's credit. Kim Phuc, the girl in the picture, and other eyewitnesses continue to back up its account. And more than 400 photographers have signed an open letter supporting him. David Burnett not only co-wrote that letter, he was also outside Trang Bang in 1972, photographing for the New York Times.
I have this very distinct memory looking down the road and seeing the kids finally run through the field and onto the road. Nick was the only one who was down the road far enough to make that picture.
Just this week, Ut and his legal team watched the documentary for the first time.
This is not journalism. This is fantasy filmmaking.
Jim Hornstein is Ut's attorney.
Nick Ut is disgusted by the film. It's a alternative universe created by Gary Knight and the Seven Foundation. And they have chosen to rely on totally unreliable witnesses and an alleged forensic workup, which is completely destroyed by the AP report and will be destroyed by our own expert.
Hornstein told NPR Nick Ut did take that famous photo, and he's preparing to file a defamation action against the filmmakers. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Warmer weather, which we're certainly having in Washington, D.C., generally means more time spent outside, and for some, that time is spent in the yard, which may look a little sad with patchy grass or weeds. Ecologist Doug Tallamy thinks yards can become little national parks, lush with beautiful plants.
I think it because I've seen it happen. It's happening right at our house.
Tallamy is the co-founder of Homegrown National Parks. That's an organization that encourages people to grow native plants in their yards. He says his home in Delaware is a prime example.
I started with oak trees because there was a white oak down the street that had dropped a bunch of acorns. And we really had pretty much a blank slate. So I just grabbed those acorns and stuck them in the ground. Didn't cost a thing.
And he got some additional help from the neighbors.
There are blue jays bringing in acorns and beech nuts. There are gray squirrels and red squirrels and ants and all kinds of wildlife moving seeds around all the time.
Not sure I'm thrilled about the ants, but the yard is thriving and making a home for the birds.
I've been counting the number of birds that have bred on our property. We're up to 62 now.
Tallamy says there are plenty of resources to help you figure out what to bring in.
You can find out what the best plants are for the county you live in by going to a National Wildlife Federation website called Native Plant Finder and putting in your zip code. So you don't have to guess. Now you know what they are.
Native plants can also be cost effective.
You don't need fertilizer. You don't need extra water after they're established. And in the long run, that's environmentally much, much better. And yes, it will save you money.
So I've actually looked up this website. It is interesting. In my zip code, you can get goldenrod, strawberries, sunflowers, Joe Pie weeds, violets. Although in my yard, I'm more likely to just go for three-leaf clovers and plain old weeds. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.